Good afternoon. It's 6 minutes after 12 o'clock. I'm Bill Radke. Is Seattle too welcoming to homeless people, too heartless? That is the first story in our Friday Week in Review. And my guests this hour are Crosscut's Mossback, Knute Berger. Hey, you, Knute.
Hey, Bill.
Former Attorney General Rob McKenna. Hi, Rob.
Hey, Bill.
Writer and stranger genius Leslie Hazleton. Thanks for coming, Leslie.
Thank you, Bill.
This week, Seattle's mayor issued an emergency order to quickly open two safe parking sites for people who live in their vehicles. These sites are in Ballard and Delridge. This is good news to Magnolia resident Harley Lever. But Lever also wants the city to go further and ban people from parking their RVs anywhere in the city but these two new designated lots. He says people are manufacturing and dealing drugs out of their RVs, dumping trash and sewage, running prostitution, and stealing from people who live nearby.
If you're a homeless vet, if you are a drug addict, if you are someone trying to escape sex abuse, we can't let drug dealers, prostitution rings, and burglars live among you. You know, the first victims of these crimes or these criminals are often the homeless people. So we need to separate them. And then the other thing is it really just is about saving resources. I mean, we spend the third most out of any city with homelessness, and that's I think it's a great thing about Seattle. The problem is we have homelessness went up 21% last year. So this is about saving resources because the police can't handle it, the parking enforcement can't handle it, and SDOT is getting overrun. You know, they can't handle it. So we've got more desperate people out on the streets that need our attention, and I think that as many resources as we could possibly shift towards them is important in the short term.
On the other hand, we talked with the director of the Interfaith Task Force on Homelessness. Bill Curlin Hackett says an RV parking ban is a sledgehammer approach.
We want more precise remedies that don't harm the people who are most at risk. And that's always my concern. I mean, no offense to the neighbors. You know, when we have a roof over our head, we're not the most at risk. So when you talk about banning all RVs from the streets, for example, I just kind of go, well, where would they go? It is very difficult to survive as a homeless person. We had more than 65 people die on the streets last year as homeless. Mm-hmm. I agree that the ability to restrict where people park on the street doesn't necessarily criminalize them, but to say they can't park anywhere on the street then becomes a constitutional issue because they have the same freedoms we all have.
Leslie, here we are opening vehicle camping sites. More tent camps are coming. Do you feel that Seattle is welcoming to homeless people or heartless to homeless people?
Are we welcoming or heartless? You know, I can't help feeling that this is a somewhat self-regarding question. You know, do we pat ourselves on the back on having done enough, or do we need to do more? And so the we involved here is not the problem. We need to focus on people who do not have homes. And the problem with homelessness comes down essentially to that little matter of a home, of somewhere to live. So when we have a proposal like this one, it smacks to me of sort of interim consensus politics. Okay, well, at least we can agree to do this much. It doesn't go anywhere near addressing the basic problems, which are, first and foremost, the lack of an actual home, you know, of a solid home. Secondly, a whole mix of social, educational, and cultural issues of vets coming back with PTSD, of illiteracy, of drug addiction, of simply not being able to make the rent and being forced out of your home. All these things, it needs a multifaceted approach. So just establishing, you know, saying, okay, you can park here and we'll give you a honey bucket seems to me like a very, to put it mildly and to put it politely, interim approach.
Rob, can we solve homelessness by giving people homes?
Well, it doesn't seem like we can because word gets out that we're providing homes and more people arrive from elsewhere to take advantage of that. So it's a really tough problem.
This is the knock some people have is that we are seen as Free-attle. So this is why I asked, do you feel that we are overly welcoming or give too many services to people?
It's a hard thing to say because the need there is real. There are families that are homeless, families with children living in their cars. And there's no really empirical way that I'm aware of to establish that. Although I suppose you could do research to figure out how many of the people you're helping are recent arrivals. The problem is, even if you decide that some of them are, or a significant number are, can you say no to them and say, well, no, you have to be here for X number of days before you're eligible? I mean, maybe, but it becomes a really hard problem to draw lines. And so,
do you really think people come to Seattle because they hear there's free meals or a shelter?
Yeah,
or
absolutely. Folks, word gets around and they can get a bus ticket and move. Sure. I've seen that happen in California, for example. People will move for other reasons, too. People who are homeless will move, if they can, to places that are warmer or drier. Go to Southern California.
Move to Seattle.
Yeah. So but look, here's the thing.
That was ironic.
The thing about the RV, consolidating the RVs, that I think makes sense is it's the same reason it makes sense to have encampments. Because it turns out if you get these folks together, they're safer, and a kind of community springs up that becomes self-regulating in some ways and regulated from the outside in other ways.
There's going to be sewage disposal services, trash pickup, caseworkers there?
Yeah, exactly. And so to the extent that there's crime associated with some of these people and drug use, et cetera, what we've seen with the encampment experiments over the last, over 10 years now, I think we started them back in the late 90s, early 2000s, we've actually seen they work pretty well. I had some of them located in my district when I was on the county council. Neighbors opposed them. And then afterwards, they discovered, you know what, this actually works pretty well. And as long as it's not permanent, that we're just taking our turn at hosting it, this isn't so bad. So I think that this is worth trying. The Mayor Murray's decision to try this is the right idea, at least to find out if the same thing will work for these, you know, RV dwellers as it has for people who are living in tents and in the tent encampments.
I do want to talk more about neighbors hosting. Knut, I'd like to hear your thoughts on this.
Well, first of all, we tend to think of it as the homeless, but as Rob was alluding to, it's a really much more complex population than that in terms of people being homeless for different reasons. So you have to find a way to get people into some sense of community and provide services for what they need, whether that's, you know, it could be drug or substance abuse issues, it could be joblessness, could be mental health issues. So we need to do a whole lot more. And this goes back to what Leslie said. There's a larger societal thing. But part of this is the other side of our prosperity system. Homeless people, people without jobs come to Seattle for the same reason that other people come to Seattle. Mm-hmm. They come here because of our prosperity. This has been shown in the past when we've had huge influxes of people without jobs, which happened in the early 1900s. It happened in the 1930s. And here we have an economic situation where a lot of people went through the Great Recession. They did not share in the so-called recovery. They come hoping for a better life. And I think Seattle, you know, we're happy to spend billions of dollars to make Boeing happy. I think we ought to make a much bigger commitment to being a welcoming city for these folks, too, and helping them transition and move up the ladder.
Well, let's talk about solutions. The Low Income Housing Institute says Medina should be offering shelters and meals. You know, why are we concentrating people away from residential neighborhoods? What do you think of that?
Well, I think they're basically right. I mean, I think having it spread makes sense in some ways. In other ways, you also have to put people near the services. I mean, one of the reasons so many homeless people come to Seattle is because there are no services in the outlying communities. And some of those communities, you know, will give a bus ticket to somebody to Seattle to get a shelter or get service. So I think there has to be a kind of a larger and there are agencies, you know, in the county and elsewhere doing things.
Especially transitional housing, where housing is cheaper. But yes, lots of services are concentrated.
Yes, yeah. But I do think there is some benefit to having everybody share in the responsibility of making sure that a neighborhood or a community is working if it's helping on this issue.
Leslie? Should homeless people, and that is a catch-all term, I realize, be more visible and more integrated? Because some of the people say these parking lots, that's concentrating people in a really helpful way. We should concentrate homeless people in a big shelter in an industrial area. If in Soto and, yeah. and help a lot of yeah. people.
You know, I'm Jewish, so you use the word concentrate.
I'm sorry.
And it sort of doesn't resonate well with me. And this idea of concentrating homeless people and so on does not resonate well. But we seem to be operating on the assumption here that if someone is homeless, they will remain homeless, that this will remain a problem and so on. Surely the idea of all these services that are being proposed that may or may not actually come into being, surely the idea is that they will not remain homeless, that they will find jobs, get treatment, find a permanent shelter, you know, one way or the other. And
yes, there's a lot of churn in that category.
There was a lot of churn and a lot of hope. And, you know, as Knut pointed out so eloquently, people do come here out of hope. Everybody comes here out of hope for one thing or another. That's why we all came to Seattle.
What did you hope for in Seattle?
Beauty, peace, serenity. I live on Lake Union, so it's easy.
Final thoughts, Rob McKenna, on concentrating people, sorry, Leslie, or, you know, versus spreading people out who have little means.
Yeah.
In wealthy neighborhoods.
So I've thought about this for many, many years, dating back to when I lived on the south side of Chicago, when I was attending law school at the University of Chicago. And I would frequently pass the Robert Taylor homes and other public housing projects, which were hideous monuments to the mistake of over-concentrating too many people facing real challenges. And since then, Chicago and other cities have moved away from that model. They're making housing available that's, you know, for low-income folks spread around so that these folks who need housing are integrated with the rest of society. We have some low-income housing in Newport Hills, where I lived for over 20 years. Works extremely well, in part because those kids go to school with other kids who are middle class or even upper middle class. That's much better than concentrating people who may be facing challenges altogether.
Yeah.
Now, having said that, when it comes to a homeless encampment where you have a much smaller number of people or maybe RVs, it actually, for the reasons I mentioned earlier, I think works. At least it's worked for the encampments. And I don't think it's that big of a risk to try it with the RVs. We've got a group of RVs that park down in Factoria in South Bellevue. They don't seem to be causing any problems, and I don't know if it's needed there. But it seems like in parts of Seattle it has become a problem the way it's working now. So if you know it's a problem now, why wouldn't you want to try something different and see if it works better?
Coming up on the Week in Review, if we want people to smoke less, how do we do that? And how much etiquette is there? And should there be in a former frontier town? Stay tuned. Thanks for tuning in to the Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke. Leslie Hazelton blogs at The Accidental Theologist.
Correct.
What does that mean?
It was not something I ever intended to get involved in. But I do seem to be involved in various matters to do with religion, belief, disbelief, wonder, awe, all those big questions, so-called big questions.
Well, we're going to talk about some big questions surrounding a big church in a moment. Leslie's upcoming book is Agnostic, A Spirited Manifesto. Rob McKenna, former attorney general and King County Council member, and Knut Berger is the Mossback, writes for Crosscut.com. This week, the Archdiocese of Seattle actually on Friday published a list of clergy and church workers who either admitted sexually assaulting children in Western Washington or the Archdiocese considers the allegation against them established or credible, in their words. And some of these names and incidents take us back to the 1920s, 77 people on this list. This week, Archdiocese spokesperson Greg Mignone assured us that the church has changed.
There was a period of time when some of those who were given that sacred trust did not honor the trust, and the church itself and some of its leaders did not respond in the way that they should have. That is certainly true, but now we're taking responsibility for those failures of the past. We're acknowledging them. We've apologized repeatedly. And one of the things that individuals can do if they either suspect abuse or have been abused is that they can request a meeting with the Archbishop so that he can meet with them and personally offer his apologies to them.
Some people say that apology and this list of abuser names is not enough. Mary Dispenza, with the group Survivors Network of Those Abused by Priests, told us that her priest raped her, that priests are still abusing children, and the church and the Seattle Archdiocese have not changed enough.
I think there is such a degree of secrecy in the culture of the priesthood, and I think it would be impossible and an error to think that now we've released 70-some names and so we can sit back for a while and believe that we've identified everyone. I don't want the diocese or the good people in the pews to sit back and go, breathe a sigh. Oh, great. This, you know, this is taken care of now. We can put that aside. We cannot put it aside because priest abuse continues to go on probably right now as we are speaking, some child or youth or vulnerable young adult is being taken advantage of by a clergy member.
Rob McKenna, church-going Catholic, how much do you trust your church that it has changed enough to police itself now?
Yeah, I think it has changed. I think that the desire for change is real. I think that it's finally the desire for change and recognition of the underlying problem, even crisis, which I don't think is too strong a word, has reached the highest levels of the church with Pope Francis. And so I do think they've taken steps. They took far too long to get there. They were in a state of denial for many, many years. Real harm was caused by
a very self-serving denial, right?
Absolutely. It was just terrible. I think the archdiocese and the church generally are correct that this is not a problem that is unique to the church. We've seen problems with youth sports coaches, teachers, scout leaders over time. But you know, as a leader in the Boy Scouts, I will tell you that organization has gotten on top of this issue much faster and much sooner than the church did by admitting it and by putting into place very strict rules that help prevent it. For example, there's now a rule that a scout leader is not allowed to be alone with a boy or a girl, because more and more girls are in scouting. You have to have two adults. It's called the two-adult rule, but there always has to be at least two adults. You know, for example, a scout leader can't take a boy home by himself in the car. You know, the church needs to be thinking about whether it needs similar kinds of restrictions and rules in order not to protect itself, but to protect the people they're supposed to be serving. So hopefully they'll continue to look at the issue and think about and enact changes so that if, in fact, any abuse is occurring, it can be rooted out and, more importantly, prevented in the first place.
Leslie Hazelton, how much do you trust that the Catholic Church has changed enough to police itself? If that's
Isn't
the right
it strange
word.
When a religious organization asks you to have faith in it, which is what we mean basically when we say that you trust someone, you place your faith in that person? I think it's very, very difficult for a non-Catholic. For many Catholics whom I know are having a terrible crisis of faith about this. Because, you know, if you look at that list, it was 77 people on it, nearly all men. And time after time, you look to see what action was taken. And you could see, obviously, the superiors knew what was happening. They'd been shunted around from one parish to another, sometimes up to 10 or 12 times. Most of them were either deceased, that's convenient, or laicized. In other words, they're not priests anymore. They've just been chucked out and they're just, excuse me, the one word I was looking for, serving time in jail, being punished, etc. There were a few, I mean, less than a handful, one, something called permanent prayer and penance. I have no idea what that entails. But and moreover, the list only went up to 2008. So are we really to believe that absolutely nothing has happened in this archdiocese since 2008, in the last 8 years? Of course we can't. And this is the horror, on top of all the horrors that have already happened. And, you know, as Rob says, it's not just in the Catholic Church. It's in the Evangelical Church, too. There have been rabbis, there have been imams, and so on and so on. Anybody in a position of trust, right? But especially when that trust is established in the name of religion, in the name of good faith, and then it is betrayed so horrendously. And you know it's still going on. You know it. And it's just... I want prison time. I want the church to fully open themselves up to criminal investigations, to handing these people over for prosecution, because that is what really needs to be done. Why should the church be exempt from prosecution?
Well, there are three important words, statute of limitations. Knut, you want to weigh in here?
I agree with Leslie about making sure that criminal behavior is caught and punished. I think that is really important as far as, if nothing else, as far as the culture really taking this seriously. One of the problems with the statute of limitations in cases, and I'm not an expert on that by any means, but I do know from personal experience, relatives and that kind of thing, that often these issues related to people who've been abused as children don't even come out until you're maybe in your 40s or 50s. Mm-hmm. You might not even recognize what happened. It may take you a long time. I think that there's a sense that I know in this case the diocese was encouraging people to call if they had knew of instances of abuse and that kind of thing. But is the church really the first place you're going to go with that phone call? Maybe the police ought to be the first call.
Right.
So I do think the legal system has to come into play, and people need to decide for themselves, obviously, whether they have faith in a particular system. It does strike me that the Catholic Church and, as Rob was saying, some other institutions have had long institutional ways of sweeping stuff under the carpet. Those institutional habits don't change easily.
Rob, you're a prosecutor. Should the church have more of a role in, or could it have more of a role in, following up with these defrocked priests today, the ones who are still alive, not in the church, but we monitor people who, or can we monitor people? We know that people have abused in the past often abuse again.
Well, that's right. Pedophilia is one of the most pernicious forms of sexual deviancy, and it's very hard to treat. It's almost impossible to cure. In my experience, supervising the legal work for the Special Commitment Center for Sexually Violent Predators in Washington State.
Does the church's responsibility end at defrocking?
No. And first of all, it should impose on itself, if it's not legally imposed already, a duty to report. Other folks in our society are statutorily obligated to report when they're aware of someone committing abuse. So that the church should adopt that as its own policy if it's not already imposed on it by statute. Number two, it should fully cooperate with criminal investigations. Number three, the statute of limitations is different for child abuse, and it starts running later. I was just trying to look it up to get the exact number of years, but it's recognized that if a child is abused at the age of two, that you don't want that statute to run out when the child is nine. And so the law actually provides for a longer statute of limitations effectively. And I need to look up the details. I can probably get that in the next few minutes. But the policy already recognized it. Therefore, if evidence is brought forward as a result of the publicity around the Archdiocese's recent announcement, the church should cooperate with the investigation. And frankly, I think they would. I mean, I don't think the church now would try to stonewall that investigation, but they should be ready to provide whatever cooperation and evidence they have.
Well, we just heard two very different statements of faith and faithlessness from Rob McKenna and Leslie Hazelton. Knut, any final thoughts regarding the Catholic Church and this scandal, this crisis?
Well, I do appreciate the fact, just having followed this in the news and whatnot, that they have made progress in terms of getting these names out there and that kind of thing. So I fully appreciate that. But it's very, and I understand it's very complex because in this particular case, it crosses into areas of religious faith that operate, I don't mean morally outside the law, but that operate, there's a different set of standards for how people make decisions about things because of the religious nature of the institution. So I recognize
what's an example of that? What do you mean?
It's complicated. Well, the criminal justice system, has a different standard than having someone confess and and do certain penance or what I mean, Leslie's probably much more of an expert on this than I am, but the value of something like prayer and contemplation means something in the Catholic Church. It doesn't particularly mean something to me out in the secular world.
It sure as hell doesn't mean anything to the kids who were abused or to their families.
Right. Yeah.
Look, I want you to earn, you know, the legal fees you're paying me for me to be here. So let me tell you that, you know, the statute of limitations for rape in our state is 3 years. However, the same statute states that when rape, child molestation, sexual exploitation, incest, indecent liberties is committed against a victim under the age of 18, that violation of the law may be prosecuted up to the victim's 30th birthday. So we as a matter of policy, we've recognized this issue. And, you know, if the church has evidence, they need to step forward because the statute of limitations is probably not going to be an issue for many of those cases.
And, of course, there's the question of, you know, sort of, do we have enough people in the Seattle Police Department to even handle all these cases?
Any final thought, accidental theologist?
You know, there's so much. You don't want me to list all the horrors done in the name of religion. I mean, God knows this. It's a long, long history of it, and it's still ongoing. But if you then want to argue, as of course Christopher Hitchens did, that that means that religion itself is evil, you should also take into account all the horrors done in the name of love, including pedophilia, by the way, which pedophiles often claim, they love children.
I think it's Latin.
All the horrors, you know, the spousal abuse and so on. All the horrors done in the name of love, and yet nobody would dream of calling love evil. So what's happening here, I don't think has anything to do with religion. It has to do with criminal behavior, with the most incredible horror and ugliness. But to blame it on religion, I think, is a mistake. The thing with the Catholic Church is that, unlike any other religion, it does have a central authority. And clearly the superiors knew what was happening. Right, you can see that from the record of how these priests were shunted around. So there is responsibility, and there is clearly identifiable responsibility, and I think it needs to be prosecuted.
More of this week's top stories in the Week in Review coming up in a moment here on KUOW Seattle. With Rob McKenna, Knute Berger, and Leslie Hazelton, I'm Bill Radke with the Week in Review. McDermott wants to replace McDermott. Congressman Jim McDermott retiring after almost 30 years representing Seattle. This week, State Senator Pramila Jayapal said she's running. So is King County Council Chair Joe McDermott. We'll talk substance in a moment. But first, Rob McKenna, you've run big campaigns. How much will Seattle voters check the McDermott box? Because they've checked the McDermott box for 30 years.
Yeah, there'll be a certain number who will. It's hard to say right now how many will do that because we haven't really had campaigns yet. But we've seen many examples of elections where confusing the name of the candidate with someone else results in more votes. I remember when Secretary of State Ralph Monroe was running for re-election in 1992.
The great bluegrass artist, you mean?
Exactly right. He was running against a woman named Jean Dixon. And there's no question that Jean Dixon, you could have predicted it.
Could have predicted it. There you go.
Ba-dum-bump.
Good one.
That she was going to get more of the vote because of her name. It's absolutely what happened. So, yeah, at the margin, it'll help Joe. Cutting against that is the fact that he's got to get through a primary. And on average, primary voters are better informed and therefore might be less likely to confuse him. At the same time, on my third hand, people might be comfortable with the name. And even though they know he's not the same person as Jim McDermott, they said, well, that's a name I'm used to. And, look, it's happened. It happens a lot. You see the children of famous politicians running, and they always get a bump from, if it's a popular famous politician, they get a bump.
Knute, since Pramila Jayapal is in the state Senate from South Seattle Renton, do we assume she has no problems with an Indian name?
Yeah, I don't think that'll be a problem in Seattle. McDermott, yeah, maybe has kind of a marginal advantage with voters who aren't paying close attention. But I think voters will pay close attention in this race. The 7th District, it's a very urban district for the most part. It's kind of the core of liberal Seattle. And a lot we still don't know. I mean, there still may be other big name politicians that get into this race.
Brady Walkinshaw is the only one.
Brady Walkinshaw,
so
and he announced before McDermott said he was going to be out. So he was willing to take on the incumbent. Even when that wasn't assured. The thing about that job is it's going to be a safe, very liberal candidate, and probably safe for the foreseeable future. So a lot of politicians would like to have that job. You know, Jim McDermott was often called congressman for life.
For life.
Jim McDermott, he had to step aside. There were Democrats, even liberal Democrats, who were tired of him being in there, didn't feel that he had produced enough or that he was too much of a lightning rod for, you know, kind of tangential things. But by and large, he was, you know, beloved by the people of Seattle and devoted to certain causes like health care. And so it's a very appealing position. I think the three candidates who are in already, McDermott, Waukesha, and Jayapal, are all great candidates. You know, we're not, I mean, I'm sure Mike the Mover's on his way, but you know what I mean. It's, I think it's a good start. It'll be interesting to see who else jumps in.
Bill, a point I want to make also is that the issue of name ID won't be completely resolved in the primary election, because there's a good possibility that under our top two primary system, where you advance to the general election regardless of party, it's just the top two vote-getters move on, that you could have two Democrats on the general election ballot. So it may be, especially if the field becomes more crowded, that McDermott's name ID advantage will be enough to get him through to the general, where, again, his name will probably help, considering that Congressman McDermott has been reelected by, you know, in the high 70s and low 80s for many years. Last in 2014, in the last congressional election, two Republicans advanced in eastern Washington in the 4th congressional district. So that could happen. But let me just put in a plug for listeners out there who might be consider themselves libertarians. Maybe there's some young woman or man in tech.
You're recruiting.
This would be a good opportunity for one of them to consider filing as a Republican and looking for a lot of crowded field, potentially making it through to the general election as a result. And you know, as a Republican, I would say, and I know my Democratic counterparts feel the same way, it doesn't matter how good a chance you think you have to compete everywhere. And this could be a good chance for a libertarian-leaning Republican to get in there and help redefine the party in that district. So that's my advertisement, but I think
thank
the
you.
Odds are you'll end up with, you know, otherwise you end up
Rob
with
McKenna
Democrats.
Approves this message.
There you go. Yeah, well, I was going to say, more like Seattle is a two-party town. It's a Democrats and socialists.
Right.
You know, and it seems to me that, and I would say small S socialists, and some of those people may be attracted to some of the Democratic candidates, but you know, it'd also be a bully pulpit for maybe somebody from Shama Sawant's party, the Socialist
Truly.
Alternative, to run, and that might create an interesting. You might end up with a final with a Democrat and a Socialist. And
here, well, I'm entirely partisan here. I am just so delighted that Pramila Jayapal is running, because Jim McDermott has been a very, very good congressman, and she will be a great one.
Leslie Hazelton, a friend scolded me because I knew nothing about some judicial candidates, so I voted for the woman. Uh-huh. And so I was A, stereotyping, and B, too lazy to research the candidates. Fair, right?
In a way. Listen, I support Pramila not because she's female.
No, I'm not suggesting
she's
that.
Brown, but because she's really, really, really good and progressive and really cares about the issues that I care about. And I think will take effective action on them in D.C., just as she has been doing in Olympia. But yeah, there are times when I get that ballot, and you know, the Washington ballot, it's like homework. You sit down with your voter's pamphlet and so on. I mean, it takes at least an hour, right? You read everything and you weigh everything. And of course, the judges, you have to make phone calls to friends who are lawyers in order to find out which judge is which, and, you know, lawyers you more or less agree with politically and so on, because it's just so hard to figure out who's who. But yeah, all other things being equal, which of course is never the case, but all other things being equal, if I have a choice of two candidates in my favor, sure, I will. In my vote, I will make my own, admittedly rather pointless and very, very minuscule little stand for affirmative action, and I will vote the woman or the minority.
Here's to pointless and minuscule democracy. Again, we've got three candidates and maybe at least one more on the way, and more if Rob McKenna has something to say about it. More coming up on the Week in Review. Stay tuned. KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke. Washington State is considering raising the smoking age from 18 to 21. Only Hawaii makes you wait that long to smoke. Yay or nay? Simple. That simple. Knute?
I'm a nay. I think you ought to have one age at which you consider people adult and they can make their lifestyle choices.
We have different standards for going to war and voting and having
a driver's license? Yeah, whether you're talking about tobacco or pot or alcohol or whatever, I think we ought to end up with one basic standard. I certainly think, you know, if you can drink in Idaho at 18 or you can go to war, that smoking cigarettes. I don't agree with raising the bar. Do I think, you know, everybody ought to smoke? No. I used to smoke. I started smoking. It was illegal, but I started smoking, I think, at age 13. Something like that.
Who really waits until they can legally smoke?
You know, we'd be up at the store on Beacon Hill that sold illegal cigarettes to young teens, and the police patrol car would pull up, and the officer would get out. He'd make us pull out our pack of cigarettes. He'd grind them into the heel on the sidewalk. He'd get back in his car and drive off. That was how the law was enforced when you were 13 or 14.
Leslie, you told me you're a smoker.
Yes, I should really recuse myself from this discussion. That's where this voice comes from, is smoking.
Is that right? When did you start smoking?
Anybody got one? No. I really don't remember. I mean, personally, I can tell anyone of any age who hasn't yet started smoking and who is even thinking of accepting a cigarette, don't do it, because it is definitely the most addictive drug known to man or womankind.
Okay, but, so legal age to be age, to 21?
Say, as you say, if someone's going to smoke, they're not going to wait for legal age in any case. It might be a waste of money sort of enacting
that. That sounds like an argument for raising the legal age to 70. But
yeah.
I support raising it to 21, and I'm glad Attorney General Ferguson is proposing this because it'll save lives. I worked very hard on tobacco issues as AG, and the settlement agreement with the tobacco companies from the late 90s, which Chris Gregoire helped negotiate, which I then helped enforce, has driven down youth smoking to its lowest level ever, perhaps. And that's just going to save an enormous number of lives. The reason is very straightforward. The studies show that if you don't start smoking by the time you're 21, the likelihood you will ever take up the habit is quite low. Almost everyone, certainly a very high percentage of people who smoke, started when they were younger. And so right now we're making it harder for people who are under 18, which is good. We can raise it to people who are between 18 and 21. Yeah, I get it. People won't like the paternalism. They won't like the inconsistency. But I like the idea of saving those lives.
Because you like the nanny state and more regulation.
Nannying, the better. But this is a life and death matter, quite literally. And, as Leslie pointed out, this is an extremely addictive substance. And I say it, I mean nicotine. I think that looking at the balance of equities, it makes a lot of sense to raise the smoking age.
Yeah, so Knut, how is civic duty the same as buying a pack of cigarettes? In other words, why be consistent about the age of adulthood when we're talking about very different things that we're letting people do? We want people, as a society, we want people to go to war when we ask them to. We want people to vote and drive. We don't want them to smoke. So
yeah,
one age?
Well, I just think there ought to be a standard, a legal standard. I think it ought to be consistent. And I'm certainly not encouraging anyone to start smoking. I mean, I quit my early 20s, and I'm glad I did. And it's a bad habit. But I think we should live in a society where people can make that choice when they become adults, and we ought to be consistent about when that age is.
Okay, so we can all agree on age 70 then, yes? at least you were polite about it, Knut. We're going to talk about how much etiquette a Northwesterner really ought to have. That and more coming up on The Week in Review. KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke with Leslie Hazelton, Knut Berger, and Rob McKenna. You know, with so much change going on, our region booming, neighborhoods morphing, it's comforting to know that some things remain the same. And here I'm speaking of Tim Iman tax measures being declared unconstitutional. A King County Superior Court judge struck down Iman's latest initiative to get passed by the voters. It gives the legislature two choices. Either you send a state constitutional amendment to the voters that would make it harder to raise taxes. It would raise the bar so lawmakers would have to get a two-thirds supermajority to raise your taxes. Or, if the legislature doesn't want to do that, doesn't want to put that to the voters, fine. The sales tax drops by 1 percentage point. Tim Iman, how would you describe your reaction in 6 words?
I was really shocked by it.
You really were?
Really?
I really was. And I was probably the only one that was surprised. Everybody else had this conventional wisdom. Well, it's a King County judge. Of course he's going to strike the thing down. Everyone thought that. I read the legal briefs and I sat through the oral arguments. I mean, I really thought there was no way you could come to any other conclusion. But this judge just said, you know, I'm going to go in my direction and stuff. So, you know, that might play in King County, but it doesn't play statewide. I mean, the voters of this state said this is what we want. And I don't think that there's any doubt that this is what the voters understood when they voted for the initiative. This is what they want the legislature to do. And the question is, will the legislature do it, or do we have to do a seventh initiative?
Former Attorney General Rob McKenna, was this just a King County judge being all liberal?
No, I don't think so. I think that any number of judges across the state would have reached the same conclusion, principally because of the strong protections that we have in our Constitution around amending the Constitution. Fortunately, we're not one of those states where you can directly amend the Constitution by initiative. You, as with the U.S. Constitution, you need the legislative branch by a supermajority to approve, to propose and approve the amendment. Then the voters get their say, where a majority of them can choose to approve it or not. And the problem with 1366 from that standpoint is that it was attempting to get around that normal process which protects the Constitution from amendment.
And why was it even on the ballot? Why did they make us vote for it?
Well,
so obviously unconstitutional.
It's a fair question.
Thank you.
The court has been asked.
Etiquette in just a moment. Yeah. Go on.
The Supreme Court has been asked from time to time to weigh in on proposed initiatives before they've been voted on, and you know, appropriately they don't do that. Just like they don't weigh in on the constitutionality of proposed legislation in the legislature until it's been adopted. That would be inappropriate. It would be a violation of the separation of powers principle.
Oh.
So you bad boy.
Thank you.
That's right. Here, so that's why.
Yeah. Okay. Canute, this happens over and over to Tim Iman initiatives. Should the voters give up trying to write the rules on when taxes can go up?
Well, should they? You know, my personal opinion is yes. But no, they won't. And Tim Iman certainly won't give up. I mean, he has an email out this morning to his supporters saying he's going to do another initiative, certainly encouraging the Republican Party to take over the House in this year's election. They're only a vote or two away from being able to do that. He people tend to think of Tim Iman as kind of, you know, unprincipled and self-serving with his initiative process. And you can argue that he is.
And he makes a living at it.
But he's not out there doing, you know, pro-tax initiative. He's not just in it for the money. There's an ideological core there.
Uh-huh.
And disrupting government is a fundamental principle that he has there. He wants to starve the beast. And, and it was obvious that this was a kind of a creative initiative effort to create, a circumstance in which he could force a vote on a constitutional amendment. It didn't work. I have no doubt that he's going to try again. I think up for discussion too is what do we do about there is a simple majority of people who believe that the two-thirds majority should be the rule.
Right.
I'm not sure there's a two-thirds majority that thinks two-thirds should be the rule.
As you know, Skip,
that would be a 4/9 majority, I think, total.
There have been a number of voter-approved initiatives in the last several years that have imposed and then reimposed the two-thirds requirement for legislative tax increases. And at least one of them passed by nearly two-thirds. I think it was around 65%. Currently, as well, the research shows that 65% of voters believe the legislature ought to send a constitutional amendment to the ballot. This is a state which is commonly thought of as being blue, which is a bit of an exaggeration when you look at the Republican control of Senate and near tie in the House, et cetera. However, one thing we know is that even a lot of Democrats or Democratic voters are pretty conservative fiscally, which is why these measures, dating all the way back at least as far as the car tabs measure, pass by really big numbers.
Okay.
So the solution here is probably not another initiative which is trying to get around our constitutional approach to these issues. The solution is for the legislature to respect the will of the voters and pose a two-thirds requirement on themselves, which the court would allow.
I have another solution. an alternate solution.
Please.
If, as Knut says, Iman's aim is to starve the beast, I see no reason why the beast should roll over and behave like a pussycat. So what I propose is an initiative. I realize there were various objections to this, but I do propose an initiative to ban Tim Iman from ever proposing another initiative again.
That's a very targeted initiative.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that would require a constitutional amendment as well to repeal the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution.
Someone's civil liberties.
And it's corollary in the state.
Well, I had a suspicion there'd be a little problem with that.
Well, hey, give the people what they want.
A lot of progressives don't like initiatives because they don't like Tim Iman and the way he's gamed the system. And but I think it's funny because there are a lot of progressives would be giving a lot. I mean, we had the pot initiative. We had gun control initiative. May have a minimum wage initiative. There, progressives are figuring out how to use initiatives. I'm in support of them.
I'm in support of them?
I'm in support of
them. Your words,
well,
sir.
Iman is in supports initiatives. No, but I am in support. And a lot of the resistance to initiatives is bipartisan and comes from the legislature, which does not like an outside authority, meaning the voters, to make law for it.
The one thing, Bill, that you mentioned that some, you know, IMA's initiatives have been struck down before, but don't forget that at least two of them have subsequently been enacted by the legislature. The Car Tabs initiative, which was struck down on the same basis of violating the single subject provision of the Constitution, and the property tax limitation measure. They were both subsequently enacted by the legislature. So IMA does have an effect. And one of the effects of 1366 was to keep this issue in front of voters and in front of policymakers in terms of whether there should be a two-thirds requirement for the legislature to raise taxes.
At the risk of cutting you off short, Mr. McKenna, I would like to talk about your manners in just a moment as the Week in Review pulls into the station. Stay tuned. KUOW's Week in Review. Thanks for tuning in. A Seattle restaurant is trying to start an etiquette revolution. That's what El Gaucho calls its classes. You buy dinner, pay $175 a person, and you get an etiquette course. How to host a meal, the menu, the seating arrangement, the greetings, the RSVP, the napkin in the lap, the conversation, the place settings, how to eat bread, how to eat soup. Obviously, this is El Gaucho marketing its elegance. I want to know, Knut Mossbach, how concerned should a Seattleite be about etiquette?
Well, we're a very tolerant society. I think people into etiquette in that way. It's kind of like a fetish, and we ought to, you know, allow those people to get together and dress up and read Emily Post and do whatever they want. You know, the whole concept of it is very anti-Seattle. I mean, you could argue that Seattle was founded by people who didn't give a damn about etiquette. In fact, wanted to escape etiquette. And it certainly wanted to escape the sort of class society represented by the East Coast. And, you know, we've had large surges in population in the past. You know, these people were crowding into bars and, you know, with mud on their boots. And, you know, people still feel perfectly comfortable wearing hiking boots to the opera here. I find it amusing. I think it's very funny that people want to go out and do that. But I just look at it as a kind of kinky deal.
Leslie Hazelton, you are a Brit, so obviously when you hear Knut speak up for raffishness, you respond like Margaret Dumont. You are shocked because you're so proper, right?
Shocked and appalled. I lived for 13 years in the Middle East, where the height of etiquette is to share. You share the table. You share the food. You eat from each other's plates. I still do that. You say, taste this. Hey, taste that. Hey, let's get a salad together and so on. Let's all eat from a central plate. You have this sense of fellowship around the table. And etiquette, of course, being so very, very British, even though it's a French word, doesn't have that sense of fellowship. I don't know if you saw the photograph that went with that article, but you have these women sitting.
This is the Seattle Times piece. Yeah,
at least arms length apart. They're holding their glasses very delicately in their hands.
Your pinky is raised.
Precisely. And and smiling kind of falsely, which I don't blame them for. El Gaucho wants you to pay $175 and then is going to teach you how to eat. I mean, is this chutzpah or what? Somebody at El Gaucho has been ODing on Downton Abbey.
So we're all agreed that etiquette is way overrated and you should just let your rough side out, right? Share the food and relax the rules, Rob McKenna.
I think that bad etiquette affects the experience of people you're dining with and potentially the people around you, depending on how
in a wonderful way.
not in a good way at all. You have to be aware of how what you're doing affects people around you. If you're talking too loudly, if you're using profanity, et cetera, I mean, it's not good for others. So it's the height of insensitivity. Having said that, I don't think one should have to pay, or hopefully people don't have to pay $150 to go learn to not be on their cell phone during dinner.
Well, there's a multi-course meal in there.
Well, you know, and I agree with Rob. I mean, I think you can teach people, especially children, by taking them out to restaurants when they're young. You can teach them basic restaurant behavior. And I don't mean – I differentiate basic politeness, keeping your voice down, et cetera, et cetera. As opposed to the kind of formalized etiquette of, you know, which spoon you're supposed to eat with which thing,
right?
Where the napkin's actually supposed to be. I mean, there's levels of this, and I think basic politeness is something, you know, people can be trained to by their parents, not by El Gaucho. And then if you want to go beyond that, it's your own business. But my
wife would say you should teach your kids those rules so that they know what the rules are. At least they have the opportunity to behave in a way that's not off-putting. It's a crime to let your kids be cluelessly impolite. Leslie, you look like you can't wait to talk.
They're so 19th century, all these words, etiquette, politeness, rules, and so on. Basically, it comes down to being a decent human being and being considerate of other people. Why can't we just talk about it in those terms? Why do we have to sort of dolly it up, fancy it up by calling it etiquette and by talking about the various spoons? And nobody eats with a full dinner service anymore unless it's a formal White House dinner.
Be decent, Rob, right?
Yeah, I think that's the core. Start with the most important things and then work your way to the less important things. But
why work your way to the less important
things? Well, here's an example. I mean, in the business world, for example, you know, not knowing which fork to use or doing something that's obviously a breach of conventional etiquette, you know, could be a problem for you. It could cause a negative impression. So at a practical level, teaching your kids
the amount of time we're spending on that eventuality, lecturing and correcting and scolding and reminding that goes into it.
Well, this is back to your point and Knut's point. It's like, it's really up to the parents. Teach the kids the basics so they don't embarrass themselves or their date. Because you never know, you might be out on a date where the other person actually does care and they've learned it. And, isn't it just common sense to learn the ground rules?
Everything off the table that doesn't have to do with eating. True, yes or no? Everything should be off the table that doesn't have to do with eating. Mm. No books. No cell phones.
That's
no
crazy. I read at the table. You know, I mean, etiquette here is like should be like how to slurp a raw oyster and whether to drink a Rainier out of a can or not. I mean, you know, those are valuable lessons.
That's living
in local culture.
Put your hands down. You are not directing traffic, says this etiquette course.
Oh,
right?
No.
Hands below the table.
Oh, no. Oh, my God.
Right.
What about
there you go.
You're gesticulating, ma'am.
Of course I am. El Gaucho is South America. Nobody gestures in South America.
I'll have to have you escorted out. That was Leslie Hazelton, a local writer, journalist. She blogs at The Accidental Theologist. Her upcoming book is Agnostic, A Spirited Manifesto. Knut Berger writes for Crosscut. He's Seattle's Mossback. Rob McKenna, former attorney general for Washington State. We're on Facebook, KUOW Public Radio. Amina El-Sadi producing the show today. Bernard Ouellette, I'm Bill Radke.